VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF game products, and Gamer's Attic, where you get the online discount, you get to support a brick-and-mortar store, and you get a free mystery gift with every purchase.
Hi, this is Wolfgang Bauer, author of Forge of War, Expedition to the Demon Web Pits, and a whole lot of independent games you probably don't know. You don't listen to The Tome, you're a sad, sorry man.
Welcome to The Tome Show, episode 105. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm joined by Mike Shea of the Sly Flourish blog, and we're going to build an elven rogue and apply all of our skills to making skill challenges that are awesome. First off, Mike Shea, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about you and the blog.
Let's see. I started playing D&D back in high school. I was actually a second edition. I started with second edition. I poo-pooed my friend who was playing first edition, who carried around all of his D&D books in his father's suitcase from house to house. And I wish I had spent more time with him. And now we are still friends, but he has long since passed D&D, and now I'm buried in it. So I've been playing on and off since I was probably 14, so 20 years or so. And played a lot of 3.5 primarily. I actually got into my D&D group in 3.5 through my wife. And we stayed with it, and then I started house ruling 3.5 because I got really annoyed with a lot of the annoying things in 3.5, and I house ruled and house ruled and house ruled it, and then realized when I saw 4th edition that I had almost completely house ruled it into 4th edition. So for me, the transition went really easily, and for my group went really easily, because we used a lot of things like I banned a bunch of classes, including wizards and clerics, and said Book of Nine Swords is all free reign, so anybody can be a Book of Nine Swords class. And then 4th edition came out, and we started playing with Keeping the Shadowfell, and we've been playing. I've had a weekly game. I've been very lucky to have a weekly game now that's been going on for almost 2 years. And where our group just hit the they're just about to hit level 14 naturally going through the game, so we're having a really good time.
Right on.
And Sly Flourish itself was, I used to write some gaming blog sites for the game EverQuest for a while, and then stopped doing that when I stopped kind of playing EverQuest and World of Warcraft didn't need any more people talking about that. So I started getting into D&D, and I said, you know, I really want to start another site, and I could talk about it on my blog all day long, but nobody really cares. So why don't I start a blog focused on D&D, and then focused even further on 4th edition D&D, and focused even further on making the DM's life better. So, you know, avoiding the typical political battles of 3.5 versus 4E and not talking about the business of wizards and not talking about whatever the hot topic is today, but really focusing the blog on making better DMs. You know, what can we do to look at everybody that's out there and really improve all of our games?
And that'll be useful in our discussion of skill challenges. Getting that focus on how to make that easier for a DM, because a lot of that is very front-loaded for the DM, and a lot of that it comes down to the skill of the DM in order to get that to pull off well, although it is also worth probably talking about when we get there as to how to be a good player in a skill challenge, I think.
Right.
All right, well, let me take a quick moment to take a break and mention our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode is a product from Venture Forth called By Skill Alone. It is a collection of skill suggestions and sample skill challenges from the Venture Forth crew that I thought was extra appropriate given our topic of conversation.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Fat Dragon Games, Green Ronin Publishing, and Wizards of the Coast. There are new products every single day. Come to rpgnow.com and get them the instant they're available.
All right, so we're going to start off by building an elven rogue. The keywords that we're using to sort of guide what we're trying to accomplish with this rogue is we want to focus on some damage output. The rogue is a striker, and as such, we want to really sort of highlight that part of the rogue and see how much damage we can get that thing that character to do. We also want to make sure our rogue is stealthy, because if your rogue can't be sneaky, are they really a rogue? And then lastly, we want to see how useful they can be other than for killing things. Get that some of that utility out of combat, whether it be getting past traps, disabling obstacles, opening locks, sort of the some of the traditional classic tropes for your rogue, but going the elven route, which is, may not always be the most obvious choice. Now, I'm going to be using the character builder from D&D Insider to help guide my building of this rogue, although most of the things that I've chosen are right from the original player's handbook. And I know, Mike, you've prepared some notes on our rogue friend.
Yeah, a little bit. I've got I run on a Mac, so for me to run the character builder, I have to load my emulator, and if I do that, I'll kill Skype. Right. So I'm going to run with text.
That's fine.
And I've surrounded myself with all of the books open to the rogue page.
So to start off with the obvious, we've decided that we're making this rogue an elf. How does the elf play into making a good rogue?
Well, the getting an extra roll on an attack really helps. And there's actually two different ways that can be used. Because one thing, particularly when you hit Paragon level, if you look at the Dagger Master Paragon path, your chance to critical to critical is 15% instead of 5. So getting that extra roll in on your attack, you may want to do it even if you hit, just to see if you can squeeze off a crit as well.
Sure.
Because your chances are a lot higher. But that extra hit is always going to help.
And there are some good Paragon feats that will bump up your critical range as well. I know I built a Paragon tier rogue recently and chose to go a different route than the Dagger Master, but still ended up with a 3-number range for my critical.
Yeah, it's really tough. I actually saw one of our players switched to a 14th level rogue in our regular campaign, mm-hmm. and last night was the first night we saw him at the table, and our ranger gave him her hunter quarry damage mm-hmm. on top of his sneak attack, and he critted.
It was
pretty awful. I think, you know, it was a, you know, some big powerful demon thing, and I think it fell in 2 hits.
So that's where the rogue apparently stuck his dagger in the demon's eye.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was pretty awful. But it was a good introduction, you know, the character, you know, it fit the character's introduction into the group to slay a demon.
I tell you, as much as people are talking about all the Player's Handbook 2 classes and discussing power creep in those and how they might be more powerful than the Player's Handbook classes, I don't necessarily agree, because I look at the rogue and you can do some really cool things with the rogue, and you can do a lot of damage with a rogue. The Player's Handbook 2 classes might be more complex to run, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of things that you can pull off with the simplicity of the Player's Handbook 1 classes.
And so, yeah, if you're fitting the Robin Laws character archetypes, I'm definitely of the Slayer variety. I like to just do as much damage and a hit as I can do when I'm playing. I'm playing a 5th level rogue in a campaign that I go to every other week.
Sure.
And my goal is just pouring damage out, and the rogue, nothing beats the rogue for just pouring straight damage out.
Yeah. So the elf makes a decent rogue because it has the elven accuracy, which lets you have a better chance of hitting more often, and you can't do damage if you're not hitting. Plus the bonus to dex is going to be useful for anything roguey. And also helps out with the sneakiness. Having low light vision is going to help you be sneakier because you don't have to be carrying around bright lights. And even having the speed of 7 squares, which is really where an elf distinguishes itself from a lot of the other races, is useful, because getting into position for that flank as a rogue to get that damage can be hugely important.
Definitely.
So looking at classes, we have the different rogue tactics to choose from. Artful Dodger, Brutal Scoundrel, and if we're including Martial Power, we also have the Ruthless Ruffian.
Right.
Which direction would you go on those to build our rogue and hit those keywords?
Hit the keywords. Again, I kind of go back to my Slayer type, and I always want to do everything as hard as I can do it. Brutal Scoundrel kind of draws me in, but I think Artful Dodger fits Elven Rogues a little bit better. Particularly that's with strength not being one of the core.
Yeah. Yeah, and I sort of looked at it the same way, because the elf part of this character is going to get more out of the Artful Dodger, because there's
right.
more Artful Dodger specifically keyed powers that play off of elven stat bonuses.
Right. It's also one of those, it's a lightning rod for opportunity attacks that it gives you. If you get that AC bonus to opportunity attacks, you're going to be hit less by opportunity attacks, which means you're more likely to want to take them.
Yeah.
Which actually will feed into a lot of the immediate actions you'll get later to let you hit the guy who tried to make the attack on you.
Yeah. Although that said,
fight happy to.
The brutal scoundrel is built to do the damage. The artful dodger is supposed to be the tricky one running through the fight and dodging in and out of things. The brutal scoundrel is supposed to be the rogue that comes in and just hits you hard and does the damage.
Right. And sometimes, particularly if that is mostly coming from the strength bonus.
Yeah.
Unless you've picked a, you know, strength-based class, you're not going to see a lot of that.
Sure. But as we look towards the future, I think if we go brutal scoundrel on this rogue, we might see a little bit less out of him at early levels. But as we start going up in levels and are able to modify that strength more and more, I think we're going to see the brutal scoundrel being possibly a bigger pool of damage.
So would you make this build's secondary attribute strength versus charisma or something like that?
Yes, I think that's exactly what I'm going to try anyway with this build. I'm going to go brutal scoundrel, and I'm going to go with the primary stat of dex, obviously, because anytime you're building a rogue, no matter what kind of rogue it is, dex has to be your big one. Every rogue power hits with dex. Almost every rogue power does damage with dex.
Right.
But sometimes they get bonuses based off of charisma or strength.
Yeah, particularly Sly Flourish, and not to pitch my own website again, but one of the things about Sly Flourish is that bonus from charisma really is really nice early on in the game and later on in the game, being it's an at will. It actually outstrips the damage of a lot of encounter attacks.
It absolutely does. I was shocked the first time I really started seeing Sly Flourish in action at early levels in my campaign, and the rogue pulls that off and says, oh, look, I did this, and then I'm doing it again and again and again and again. And it's like, holy cow, dude, settle down.
All right. 1d4 plus 12 at level 5, whatever.
Well, and then plus sneak attack on top of it if you do it
right. Right.
So, yeah, I'm going to go dex and then strength. You're going to have a decent charisma. And what I end up having is I have a lot of really moderate stats with a decent strength and a really good dex.
Right. That fits the idea of having a rogue that can do a lot of things outside of combat.
Yeah. So I went with that. And then for skills, you automatically get thievery and stealth. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously going to help you with that out of combat utility and with your sneakiness abilities. I also went with perception. It's tough to get usefulness out of your thievery abilities if you can't find the problems.
Yep, I found that out the hard way.
Yeah. After that, I decided to go really focus in on what those keywords were. And so I decided to go with dungeoneering, thinking that might play a role in being able to overcome obstacles or traps or possibly skill challenges that involve those things. And then I went with acrobatics and athletics.
A very physical rogue.
I figured the acrobatics and athletics are going to help this rogue be able to get to the problem. You know, I could see an elaborate trap setup where the rogue's got to be able to climb up this wall and squeeze down this tunnel or whatever in order to find the mechanism to disable the trap that's killing the party out in the main room.
Right. This is an area where it really helps to know what kind of campaign you're going to be playing in.
It does.
One thing I noticed, when I started a rogue, I picked a dark elf rogue and focused on charisma and dex and put a lot of skills into the dialogue-based skills, your diplomacies and intimidations and whatnot, streetwise. And then turned out the campaign was a complete dungeon delve. So there's no conversations with anybody other than the other players who already determined that they hated me, and no skill roll was really going to help me there.
Yeah.
So through the levels, I started changing all of that. And they also yelled at me every time I failed on percepting a trap. So
and that's one of those tricky sort of things is do you want to build your character to be the most effective character, or do you want to build your character to make sense given the story that you have in mind for that character?
Sure, right. Although sometimes if you go too much towards the character you have in mind and it turns out the campaign's not really supporting that that theory, you know.
That maybe you wish you'd have come up with a different really, concept.
It's like, wow, that theory worked really great until I got a, you know, trap sprung and I have an arrow in my face.
Yeah.
One other nice thing is the elf has perception as one of the skill bonuses. So getting that extra +2 to perception, and if you have any decent wisdom, and then it's trained, it's gonna put that rogue in a much better spot to perceive the traps as well as disarm them.
Absolutely.
That's a nice advantage of the elf.
Yeah. The next thing on our list is to look at feats. I don't know. I'm of the general opinion that if you're building a rogue, there's only one feat to take at first level.
Backstabber?
Absolutely. It's pretty much the only way to go. It turns your sneak attack dice from a D6 into a D8.
Yeah, which, average 2 bonus on your damage rolls.
Yeah, which, I mean, that's huge over time.
Right, and, yeah, I mean, even if you don't get it necessarily at level 1, you're going to want to get it soon.
Yeah, well, and over time it becomes even more useful because as you add more dice, that damage adds up to, you know, that average increase in damage adds up to even more.
And then when you get to those high crits, then it really matters.
Yeah, oh yeah. Because then you're doing 8 instead of the 6.
Yeah.
Any feats that you see that our rogue friend should sort of keep an eye out for the future?
Yeah, I've got 3 other feats that I think are really helpful, all that go along that. One is kind of under, this is one I actually just noticed when I was looking at this, which is Nimble Blade.
Uh-huh.
Gives a +1 bonus when using a light blade, +1 bonus to attack. I didn't double check to make sure that stacks with everything else, but given that if you have a rogue with a dagger, you already have a +3 proficiency bonus. You have +1 because you're a because you're a rogue, and then you have this extra +1 that you could get from Nimble Blade. So you're continually stacking 5% improvements on your opportunity to hit. And then, given you're going to have combat advantage most of the time, you're really pushing your attack bonus way high.
Yeah.
So that's a nice feat, but it's only a straight +1 bonus.
Sure.
I think weapon focus is another really good one, given that guys may provoke opportunity attacks from you. And weapon focusing to dex will really help you get in that dex bonus to your attack roll on an opportunity attack. I think, is it weapon focus that I'm thinking of? Is that right? The player's handbook 2 feet where you you switch to one of your other attributes for your attack bonus.
It might be weapon focus. Get it out in front of me.
It doesn't sound right now that I say.
No, weapon focus gives you a +1 per tier to your damage.
I'll find it as soon as I'm not looking for it. Weapon? No, that's not weapon expertise. Oh, where is it? Is this the right book? It is the right book. It's a relatively new melee training. There it is, melee training. It's
go.
On page 186 of the Player's Handbook 2. And yeah, this one you can choose any other basic ability score for your attack bonus on your basic melee attacks. So one thing that rogues are typically terrible at, or were until PHB 2 came out, was opportunity attacks. You really never got much of a shot because most didn't have high strength.
Yeah.
Most focused on dex, so then you'd have these really lame attack bonuses. But with weapon focus, you can get back to that really high attack score for opportunity.
Right on.
The other one I really like is slaying action. Slaying action gives you an extra set of sneak attack dice on an action point. And
yes.
One reason, any time you can get extra sneak attacks, you're in a really good spot. And I'll talk more about this with powers as well. But one thing I really like with this is that chance where you stand toe-to-toe with a very large brute that everyone else is afraid of, and you're by yourself, and you can pull off your regular attack, your minor attack, and your action point attack, and pull off sneak attack twice out of the 3 times.
Yeah, and that can be huge.
Watch the brute fall down dead before anybody's got much of a chance to do anything to him.
That makes that action point action seem even more cinematic, because you're not just getting in your normal attack, but you're just really laying it into him with double sneak attack damage if you pull it off well.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of the slaying action. I just got it for my 5th level rogue, and I love it.
Right on. All right, so let's move on to powers. At first level, I think the obvious pick is that you go with the riposte strike, because it gives you the extra damage with your strength. And then I was a little bit torn on where to go from there. I think I went ahead and went with the Piercing Strike just so that you have the option to go against Reflex. If the AC just isn't hitting, you get the option of going against a different defense. Always seems to be a decent idea.
That Disheartening Strike is a, I don't know if we're looking at martial power or not.
Uh-huh, that's fine.
The at-will power Disheartening Strike is one of the few that does the new rattling, the rattling keyword, where you when you hit a guy, they take a -2 penalty to attack rolls.
Sure.
And there's lots of different powers in that work off of that that work off of that attack. And the nice thing is you can do it from range as well as do it in melee.
Yeah. Although Death Strike is always a decent choice for a rogue because that extra 2 squares of movement before the attack can be just what you need to get yourself into a flanking position or pull off a sneak attack from hidden, all kinds of things you can do with that.
Right. Yeah, the only problem with that one is it's a move and not a shift, so
that's true.
It'll provoke if you happen to be adjacent to a nasty.
Yeah. And for encounter powers, I went with this is where I went off away from the player's handbook a little bit and chose the Sly Lunge from Martial Power. Gives you the extra damage from your strength modifier because we're a brutal scoundrel.
Yep.
Does your one weapon plus dex modifier damage, but then also grants you sneak attack.
A mini sneak attack.
Yeah, gets you combat advantage until your next turn. So you've whether you're flanking or not, you've got your sneak attack for next turn set up.
Right.
And then if you don't get your sneak attack on this one, you get your mini sneak attack. You get your if you didn't get to do your sneak attack damage, you still get an extra D6.
Right. Right. Yeah, and there's a lot of good uses for that. Again, mixing that with some of the minor action attacks that the rogue gets to make sure that you're pulling off the maximum amount of damage in a couple of attacks.
Well, and that one just does it sets up and does a lot of different things in one nice little power.
Right. Yeah, it's a real good one.
And then for my first level daily, I decided to go with Easy Target.
Mm-hmm.
This one, again, just because it sets things up. I mean, if you're going to play the rogue and you want to do the damage, you want to have combat advantage as often as possible.
It also gives combat advantage on a miss, which is nice.
Right. It grants it on a miss. On a hit, it grants it with a save, which means if the dice are working for you that night, you're going to have combat advantage for a couple of rounds.
Sure.
Which is always nice.
Yeah, that becomes one of the strategies longer term of the rogue is finding all of the different possible ways to get combat advantage.
Yep.
And making sure that you always have it in one manner or another.
Yeah, and with the ways the stealth rules work with the errata, there's a lot of things you can do with that to make sure you've got combat advantage as well.
Yeah, this is one where, particularly with the Dark Elf rogues are almost built for one another.
Absolutely.
In the sense that you always get at least 2 free rounds of combat advantage on top of all the other abilities to get combat advantage in it. It's very handy.
So are there any other powers you want to look at for the future of this rogue?
For the future or still at level 1?
Well, we can – any powers you want to look at for this rogue.
I'll tell you one of my favorite ones recently is the Low Slash, which is a level three encounter power in Martial Power, page 76.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about this is I think the first time a rogue gets an attack as a minor action. One thing that I found about rogues is they have so many possible options for minor action. Well, I guess particularly again, Dark Elf rogues have lots of possible minor actions. So you actually run into the budget constraint of your total actions, which is a little rare with characters at low levels. They tend not to have a lot of things they can do with minor actions. But the rogue with a low slash gets that extra free attack as a minor, not a free attack, but a minor attack, which can take the place of a move action if you need to, and can give you, if you miss your combat advantage attack on your first one, you can do that kind of vengeful, well, I want to do it again. And attack a second time with the low slash to get an extra shot at getting that combat advantage. It also has the advantage of giving them, slowing the target until the end of your next turn. And if you're flanking them, you deal extra damage equal to strength or charisma. So it's a pretty solid hit for a minor action attack.
That's cool.
Yeah. The only other one that I think starts at level 5, at level 5 you start to get some of the immediate reaction attacks. There's one called Flashy Repost, again on page 76 of Martial Power, which gives you the enemy makes an attack against you and you get to swing right back at him. This is one of those kind of screw the DM powers that I love when I'm a player and hate when I'm the DM who's getting screwed. But it's one of these, like, there are so many powers a DM can never keep up with what everybody's got.
Yeah.
And if you just kind of say, oh, I think I'm going to move away and kind of pretend you forgot about the possible opportunity attack, and then the DM grins and says, I'm going to take my OA, and you go, oh no, and then he takes the OA and you say, oh, I think I'll repost that, and it's a, and then get your extra hit, and if you have combat advantage, then you're doing sneak attack again, if you have not already used it that turn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of little bits like that where you get to pull one off like that. You know, I was in a game this last weekend where the cleric in the party was purposely provoking opportunity attacks so that the sword mage could pull off his mark.
Right.
And, you know, pop over and get the attacker. As the DM, it was one of those things where whenever I'd roll a critical, I'd say, hey, look, a crit. And then I'd look over at our cleric who had the armor of Bahamut.
Yeah, we got that same.
Look, I got a crit. McCory, did I get a crit? Are you gonna let this one slide through or not? You know.
Yeah, that's actually kind of an interesting 4E thing. Is this the first time I felt like the DM really isn't God anymore? And it started with having halflings who could force me to re-roll.
Yeah.
And then now having people that negate my own crits. It's a little upsetting, frankly. I feel like I've lost control of my own game.
Oh,
when the players start telling me what I'm allowed to do.
I've come to embrace it. I think it's a blast.
I do too, and I, you know, of course, I mock when I say they steal me because it's all for our fun.
And then
my monsters are not me.
And I notice more and more as I get into Paragon tier monsters that I can start pulling off the same sort of stuff to them, and they're like, "What? No, you can't do that." It's like,
right?
Oh,
actually,
now you know how it feels.
You start doing that pretty early on when you have like shifty kobolds and things like that.
Yeah.
They don't understand. So, there was one more, but I can't quite follow. Here, the sand in the eyes, a level 7 rogue encounter ability.
Uh huh.
That's a blind, and this was used very effectively by the rogue in our regular group, who used it almost every battle. And blind is an extremely it's one of the moves I refer to as the bucket on the head,
uh-huh.
where you have your great big bad evil guy, and you've been he's going to really be tearing the party apart, and then the party starts coordinating all of these attacks that almost completely incapacitate him until he's dead.
Yeah.
And it starts with the sand in the eyes, where now he's minus 5 to hit anybody and does not take opportunity attacks, and continues on with weaken and stun and slow and immobilize and everything else. Knockout is another one.
Yeah. Well,
but I think it was the sand in the eyes was the first time I really started seeing that happen.
The first time I saw it was Blinding Barrage, which is a first level power.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, that was. Right. The level 1 daily.
Yep. So where should we go with our Paragon path for this guy when we get to that level? I'm kind of torn between two different Paragon paths.
Well, until you told me that there are ways to get that 15% crit chance with other Paragon paths, I would have definitely said that the Dagger Master was the way to go.
Dagger Master is the way to go. And I guess, and I haven't looked into it, but you could still go Dagger Master, and I wonder if you can't stack some of this crit range increase with the feat.
If you can, it's probably broken.
And then, you're critting every fourth attack. And
right, that's just wrong.
My other Paragon path that I really like is I'm a big fan of the Shadow Assassin.
Yeah. Is that a PHB one?
No, Shadow Assassin is in the Player's Handbook, yeah.
Okay.
But it's definitely focused on giving you extra damage. It's got, every time an adjacent enemy misses you with an attack, it takes damage automatically based on your charisma. And then there's powers that sort of play off on that. I really like the 12th level utility power called Bad Idea, Friend, where it's an immediate interrupt. They make an attack against you. You give yourself a plus 10 to all of your defenses.
Wow.
And then if they miss, you do double of your Shadow Assassin riposte damage.
Wow.
Which, I mean, is only, 10, 8 points, whatever. But still, it's just, I like that idea.
Sure. It's a nice minion killer, too.
Yeah, yeah.
There's lots of these ones where you're only doing 1 or 2 points of damage, but if you're facing a minion, that's all you need.
That's all you need, yeah. But yeah, the Dagger Master is also a really good choice because of getting that extra range on your critical.
Yeah, that to me, only again, going back to my, I just want to do as much damage as possible. Anything I can do to increase my attack score, my damage, or my crit is going to be something that I'm going to focus on.
And it's worth noting that the Rogue, it seems like as people are turned off by the Rogue sometimes because, well, I don't want to use a little dagger. It doesn't do a lot of damage.
Oh, who cares? Right. Yeah, it's nothing you could be using a needle.
it's not about the weapon. It's about the sneak attack. It's about all the criticals that you're pulling off, you know. And then you've got the bonus of now I have a weapon that I can use as a ranged attack or a melee attack, depending on the power that I've got.
Right. That's one of the things I loved about the a magic dagger wielding rogue can throw their dagger almost as effectively as they can stab with it.
Absolutely.
In fact, as effectively as they can stab with it. And a lot of those at wills and everything else work just as well from range as they do from melee. Mm-hmm. And if you get that, if you get the higher initiative, you have combat advantage against everybody.
Yeah.
So,
really handy. Anything else you want to say about our rogue friend before we move along? We've chatted about him for a while now.
Sounds pretty dangerous to me.
All right. Then let's take a quick break and mention the second sponsor of the episode, GamersAttic.com. My pick from them for this episode is their wide selection of chainmail dice bags. You know you've always wanted one, and they have them in lots of colors and styles, and even for as cheaply as $13. And don't forget that since you're listening to the Vorpal Network, you can use the code RADIO as your coupon code when you check out and get an additional $3 off, plus a free mystery prize with every order. Or, while you're there, why not pick up the latest D&D book while you're at it?
Gamers Attic Attack! We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine. Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice within dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them! We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon. What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO. Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for Diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at GamersAttic.com.
All right. So now we're going to talk about skill challenges. And I have three things to look at and to think about that I want to sort of have guide our discussion here on skill challenges. My first topic of conversation is, as a DM, how do you run a skill challenge? Because I think that takes a certain amount of skill.
Yeah.
The second point that I think we should look at is, how do you design a skill challenge? Because that goes into your prep before the skill challenge ever happens. And then the third point I wanted to chat about was, when you're a player in a skill challenge, what can you do to interact with that skill challenge and make it fun for everybody involved without, you know, giving the DM a heart attack?
Right.
So let's start off. How do you run a skill challenge?
One thing that I've kind of noticed, and there's a lot of discussions about skill challenges on message forums and over the Twitter lines and in blogs and everywhere else. And, you know, skill challenges are kind of like asking a girl out on a date. It's only a really big deal if you make it a big deal. You know, that it's that you can if you can psych yourself out with a skill challenge and make it, you know, end up doing more damage than if you just kind of relaxed and ran your game like you would normally run your game.
Uh-huh.
So one thing about skill challenges is just and generally what I, you know, is to relax a little bit and remember that they're not anything particularly different than what we've been doing for the last 20 years with skill checks.
Sure.
So one of the things that I kind of think about is, you know, not necessarily worrying too much about the mechanics of the skill challenge as it is just kind of letting them flow organically into a game. But they are something new as well. So we always have to kind of, you know, learn a little bit more about how to run a skill challenge.
And there's some different, I guess, approaches to how to pull that off as well. I've seen skill challenges run very mechanically as they were originally written in the DMG, you know, where we go in initiative order and we go around the table and what are you doing and what are you doing and what are you doing and on and on and on like that, until, you know, you've either succeeded or failed. I've also seen it run very sort of free form organically, which I think is more the intent of the writers and how they would prefer skill challenges to go. And I think that's probably the more fun way to run a skill challenge is, like you were saying, just relax with it, run the game like you're normally running it, but then sort of keep in the back of your mind that while they're going through this role-playing encounter and they're rolling, have them roll the appropriate skill challenges on occasion or skill checks on occasion and use that to sort of guide their success or failure as they go along. Sort of keep in the back of your mind that tally of, are they going to be successful in this larger goal or are they going to fail in this larger goal? And it's a tricky balance.
Right. Here's a, you know, one of the eternal questions that I think comes up all the time and really ends up being personal preference, but do you tell your group they are starting a skill challenge or do you not tell them?
Right.
What is your opinion on that?
It depends on the skill challenge.
Really?
Sometimes I tell them, and sometimes I let them sort of figure it out when they're, you know, a third of the way into it.
Right. Yeah. I tend to not tell them. I don't, you know, short of yelling out that they should roll initiative, I don't like to tell them about any mechanical process that's going on in the game. I try to keep everything as story-based as I can. The only problem with that is I have some players who like skill challenges and some who really don't. And the minute they sniff a skill challenge, three of the people, you know, slump in their chairs and roll their eyes and, you know, start getting up to go get pizza and saying they're going to pass. You know, they'll assist someone else later. So I have to be careful about how to find ways to sneak in skill challenges, because I have a lot of tactical gamers who are all about getting to the next battle and they see skill challenges as a barrier between them and the next battle. But the other thing I noticed, my wife was not a big fan of skill challenges. And, I ran a one shot level 26 game a couple weeks ago and had a couple of skill challenges in the beginning of the game. And I said, what do you think of skill challenges? And she said, I really don't like them. And I said, what did you think of the one where the Shardarkai were surrounding you in the field? She said, oh, that was kind of cool. I said, well, what about the one where you had to climb the gates to get into the big tower area? And she said, oh, that was kind of fun too. And so what about the big rock bridge that you had to cross without alerting the people on the other side? No, that was fun too. So I realized that it was kind of like, you know, it's like Congress, you know, we hate Congress, but we like our guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, I hate skill challenges, but those last five were kind of fun.
Well, and I've really struggled with skill challenges myself because I really like skill challenges as a concept. I really like what I've seen from skill challenges that have been designed. I've really liked what I've heard from some actual play recordings of people running through skill challenges. One of my partners in the Vorpal Network, Gamers Haven, puts out a lot of actual play podcasts, and so you hear some there. The Amorphous Blobcast guys just recently did a whole skill challenge series where they ran a skill challenge just to sort of experience what it was like, and I really liked what they did there. So there's a lot that I really like about skill challenges, and then when I play them or when I run them, they're not quite as cool as I was hoping they would be.
Yeah.
Like, consistently, every time.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we one of the areas of skill challenges that everyone talks. Well, I think one thing about skill challenges that you know, we all have to get our head around, and nobody's going to admit this, is that the mechanics for skill challenges aren't nearly as well refined as the mechanics for everything else in 4E.
Right.
So we get this book that has this incredibly refined system for combat that's been, you know, refined over the past 30 years, you know, or longer, nearly 40 years of combat refinement to get to the point where we are now. But then skill challenges are really kind of a new idea. And they clearly read as kind of a new idea. And it's funny, when we talked originally about talking about skill challenges before Mike Merles put out the podcast on the Wizards site about skill challenges, where he clearly says, you know what, the long skill challenges don't work nearly as well as the short ones. And you're like, wow, if the lead designer says that the long skill challenges don't work that well, you know, maybe they need a little bit more thought. But I think the hope is that in DMG2 we'll see a lot better, you know, a lot more refinement. But on the other hand, we don't necessarily want better mechanics. You know, I mean, the whole point of a skill challenge is to you know, fill in the, you know, kind of soften the edges of this very combat focused game and turn it in, you know, get it back to the D&D we all remember of that everybody, you know, a lot of the other folks will say it has lost, which is that role playing aspect.
Yeah. And you can get a lot of that back into the game with through the skill challenges.
Yeah, if they work well, yeah.
I really like some of the things that you've said, and I think what I'm going to try to do and focus on when I'm running skill challenges in the future is, first of all, I'm going to relax, and I'm not going to tell the players they're in a skill challenge. I'm going to ask them for the appropriate checks when it comes up, and I'll just sort of keep track of things on my own. And that way, because I think sometimes I worry about, are the players buying into my skill challenge? You know,
are they
buying into it, and are they performing? Are, you know, do they understand the variety of things that they can do and should be doing? Because I don't think that they always do. But if I don't tell them it's a skill challenge and they're just role playing and making an occasional skill check, I wonder if that will change the way that works. Mm-hmm. And then if I just sort of relax and think of it as a role playing encounter, then I think I'm going to change the way I behave in the skill challenge.
I think there's a couple other kind of tips, I think, for, you know, thinking about a skill challenge, a little bit more practical than some of the stuff that a lot of people have been talking about. And one is that you want to make sure that your skill challenge makes sense and is specific to the point where your players know what to do. Because it's real easy to kind of say, you're in a city and guards are going to attack you, what do you do? But it's something else if you kind of describe the city and you describe why the guards are coming after you and what the guards are doing and who the guards are. You know, the more detail you give them, the more the richer the scene will be for the players, and the more they're going to start to get ideas about what they should or shouldn't do. And it's real easy to be too general with it, because you want to keep it general to give people options, but you need to give them structure as well so they have a general idea, you know, or a more specific idea where they're going to go. The other one, I think, and this is something I'm toying with, I've done it and it didn't seem to work, and that's to make it clear up front what they have to gain or lose if they succeed or fail in the skill challenge. That it's one thing to say, okay, the skill challenge has started and you know, you're being chased by guards. It's something else to say you are going to end up in jail and lose a lot of your gold if you fail this challenge, or if you succeed, you are going to gain the benefits of the local merchants who are going to give you a 20% cut on purchasing items. Mm-hmm. You know, if they know, I mean, and you don't have to say it that specifically, you have to find some flowery way of saying it in game. But if you say it, but if you give them an idea about what they're going to succeed, you know, what they're going to gain or lose, then they have investment in succeeding or failing.
Yeah, and I've always sort of, because I've heard some skill challenges played where the DM is very clear, you know, if you succeed, this is the impact. If you fail on this individual check, this is the impact.
Right.
And on one hand, I kind of like that, but they also had players that had a lot of buy into that sort of setup.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I wonder, is that going to, I don't know, is that going to tip my hand? You know, now they know they're in a skill challenge. They're looking for the mechanics. They're looking at the numbers, and they've stopped paying attention to what makes sense and trying to solve the problem.
Right. Yeah, I had a skill challenge I ran recently in this in the 26th level delve that I ran, where they had to cross a, you know, kind of Bridge of Khazad-dûm style bridge to get to this tower in the middle of the Shadowfell, and it was this, you know, ancient 20,000-year-old rickety stone bridge that was kind of falling apart. And I made it clear that, you know, you guys are heroes. You've traveled all over the known worlds, and you've been, you know, you're agents of the Raven Queen, and you've been doing this. You're not going to fall and die on a bridge like this. But getting across it without alerting anybody is something else. Mm-hmm. You know, so finding a way to kind of make the success or failure clear to them without just saying, if you do this, you get a surprise round. If you don't do this, they get initiative on you.
Well, and I think you could also, I think you could even add some of that metagaming information in there.
Right.
But do it with every skill check ever made.
Right.
You know,
right.
Every time they roll a skill check, you can do that and it makes sense. Right. You know, oh yes, you can make that skill check, and if you succeed, here will be the advantage, and if you don't succeed, here's the disadvantage that you might face. You know, other than making knowledge checks to find out what the vulnerabilities of that monster are, I think that could also work.
All right. There's a little bit of hypocrisy written into the design of skill challenges that's hard to balance, which is how you want to make it descriptive enough to tell players that, you know, Arcana is a possible skill they could roll. But you also want them to describe what they're doing rather than saying, I'm going to roll an Arcana check now.
Yeah.
And that kind of says, well, should I tell them what they can do, or should I wait for them to try what they're going to do?
Well, and that, you know, that gets,
that's,
that gets
that's
into
a
that
tricky thing to balance.
That gets into that second topic there of how to design a skill challenge. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
When I'm designing a skill challenge, what are the things that I need to sort of keep in mind to make sure that this challenge is going to go well? Or do I need to – how much prep do I even need to do? Can I make one up on the fly and get along okay?
Yes, you can do both. I think that it depends on the skill challenge, and the better ones – some skill challenges will be totally ad hoc and they'll be great, and that's where the magic – you know, the magic happens in D&D is when you have these kind of situations that spawn out of the ground is from the imagination of seven people around a table. But some of the more complicated ones, you want to actually sit down and I like to do this, you know, in story writing, you know, a lot of good authors will sit down and kind of visualize themselves in the mind or in the shoes of their character to kind of say, well, what would I do if I were in this place? Uh-huh. In this place. And it's also kind of nice to sit down and say, okay, if I'm going to put this, you know, giant stone door that's been locked with arcane magic and is blocking their path and, you know, throws lightning bolts at people when they try to get in, how would that door actually work? And what are the mechanics behind it? And who built it and why? And how do those lightning bolts work? And, you know, what, you know, and if you can think of it from the story perspective, thinking about how it would mechanically work for real, you can start to get those details that you can describe to the player so they get an idea of, ah, okay, if lightning bolts are coming out of this thing, you know, they're coming from this kind of power source, perhaps I can use this skill to negate that power source, you know. Or
absolutely.
I can set up lightning rods to avoid the lightning damage.
Sure, and I think that can play a lot into that discussion we were having about how do you describe it and let them know what skills are useful without telling them these are the skills that are useful.
Right. But I think
if you're describing it in a very real way, you know, right. There's lightning coming out of it and there's, you know, it's coming from this kind of a place and you do some investigation, you know, you can sort of guide them along. Oh, there's lightning. I do it. That's right. Probably magical. I'll do an Arcana check. And then they find out, okay, it is magical or maybe it's not magical. And they have right. to do a dungeoneering check to find out what's going on. And then a perception check to see where the power source is. And
exactly.
You can sort of lead them along from there.
Okay. Are you much of a video gamer?
Not much on occasion, but not.
Have you ever played God of War on PlayStation 2?
I have not.
So God of War is this action game, and there's a whole section near the end of the game where you're in this, you know, essentially you're trapped within Pandora's box. It's this uh-huh. giant bowl. And one thing that was really remarkable is they have all these traps and things that you have to avoid. But if you look in the walls and you look on the floor, you start to see how the traps work. There are giant gears and there's counterweights and there's, you know, it makes sense. Like these traps are ridiculous in their scope, but they're not just, you know, random spike traps, you know.
Absolutely.
They're not, you know, one of the things that always bothered me, you know, everybody loves Raiders of the Lost Ark, but you're wondering how did these ancient people come up with a light, you know, a light photosensitive spike trap where if you put your hand in there, it will hit you with spikes, you know, what kind of technology did they have to come up with something like that?
And I'm always amazed that they could build something, you know, 2,000 years ago that still functions today.
Yeah, right. We can't build anything today that still functions in 10 years.
Yeah.
So the more you try to think about how these things work mechanically, and this is where I think prep time can help. If you spend the time to really ask yourself how this thing works, A, you start to get an idea for what skills will work. You get an idea for what you can describe to players so they understand how this thing works and they can know what skills. And they're going to be happier because now they have something they can do.
And once you've done that, it's pretty easy to figure out, okay, well, then these are the skills that are going to be useful.
Right.
And you can sort of jot down, you know, the DCs that are appropriate for your character's level. And you could even make a lot of that up on the fly. Oh, well, this is going to be tough to do because I know it makes sense, you know? Yeah.
So the DM comes really handy for that.
Yeah. The DM screen is fantastic from Wizards of the Coast because it's got all that information on it that you need.
As long as you pasted the errata DCs on
there. Right. Right.
And the DM didn't, and we were just frustrated. That was actually, I really believe that one of the reasons my group is not fond of skill challenges is because the first three or four we ran with DCs that are way too hard.
Yeah.
And they failed almost all of them. And it's never recovered from that. You know, never.
I don't like the idea of pasting things into my products, but it's just a difference of five. So I can remember that in my head.
Yeah. Right. You know? Right. You do the math. I'm too busy to do math like that.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, and this also, you know, Mike Merrill's talked about this in the podcast, is the idea that you should not necessarily have long skill challenges, that a series of short ones can often work better than one giant one.
Yeah. And what I liked was the idea that came out of that, which was instead of doing one big skill challenge, do a bunch of little ones that string together in a way that makes sense. You know, they're
a meta skill challenge.
Yeah, they're not really separate skill challenges. They're really part of this larger challenge, but they play into each other, and you run them mechanically as little ones, which is, I think that works really well as well because it's not one. You know, you don't screw up once and ruin it. It's
right.
done, you know,
right.
you've
right.
got, you know, you can screw up one, you know, one of these skill challenges and it's okay. It makes the next one a little bit tougher, but you continue on.
And a lot of times those failures are where you're going to tell stories in 10 years about it. You know, we had a skill challenge in Thunderspire Labyrinth where you have to talk to, this is a Thunderspire, a little bit of a spoiler. But if you're in Thunderspire, there's some ghosts you have to convince them that you are strong enough to go face these big demonic trials, and the ghosts are kind of looking to sense, you know, how good you are. And again, one of our tactical players who hated skill challenges says, well, I'm going to show him how strong I am. And I'm like, well, okay, how are you going to do that? And all he had was this boar that we had rescued from a pen earlier, and he's like, I'm going to go bench press Broda the boar. So, you know, here it is, a halfling fighter you know, who crawls under this boar to bench press the boar, fails miserably, and the boar just flattens him on the ground. You know, and to this day, we still talk about the time that Envy tried to bench press Brodo, and how you know that was not the net. And there's nothing that describes that in any book.
Absolutely,
but it makes for good discussion. So finding, and this is something else they talk about, was finding how failure can actually lead to different kinds of adventures.
Well, and that's one of the keys, I think, in designing a good skill challenge, is that failure doesn't stop the story.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
Don't,
not only does it not stop it, it can divert the story into a new and exciting area.
Absolutely. And so don't set up your skill. Skill challenges are different than fighting a monster in a lot of ways, right? If I fight a monster and the monsters win, there's a total party kill and we've got to figure out how to continue the story.
Right. You know?
In a skill challenge, the players can fail every single check and completely fail, you know, out of the water, the biggest failure ever failed.
Right.
And still, the story progresses. You know, they may have been caught by surprise by the bad guys, you know, or they may end up captured and in jail or whatever it is. But the story doesn't stop because they failed. The story can continue and actually become more exciting off of that failure.
This is one thing that I haven't actually seen anybody else really talk about, but it's a big don't in my book about skill challenges, and beyond just having skill challenges that end that, you know, oh, well, you never got the key, so you're hosed.
Yeah.
But the worst one for me are skill challenges that can lead to combat. You know, if I'm trying to design, you know, if I'm sitting and saying, okay, I've got six people coming over next Wednesday night and we're going to play for 4 hours, and you know, I got to set up all my stuff and I got these three encounters that I want them to go through, and you know, this is my plan. If I then set up a skill challenge that could equal a fourth encounter, you know, my night is hosed. I mean, I'm never going to, you know, the whole timing is going to be off.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised when I read skill challenges that are published by Wizards. There's some in the DMG where you fail and you go to battle, and A, they will usually get more experience from the fight than they will from the challenge.
Yeah, that's the challenge for me, is that on one hand, it makes logical sense. And we talked about designing it in a way that makes logical sense. And so I don't have a problem with it in terms of story.
Right.
But yeah, the Diablo player in me says I want to go through every single room, even if even if it's not the fastest way to complete my goal,
because I want to fight this guy
because I'm going to get the experience, you know.
Right. Then now, so a little trick that I had is these like mini skill challenge battles where you can take an entire battle and kind of convert it into a couple of skill challenges or a couple of attack rolls and damage rolls, and just, you know, all you end up doing is basically taking surges from them.
Yeah.
You know, but it's enough that, you know, if you, you know, I had a skill challenge where they were surrounded by Shadarkai hunters in the middle of the Shadowfell. And I said, you know, if you succeed, you are heroes and you will kill them, but you're not going to get away unscratched. And those scratches will last you the rest of your adventure. And that made it clear, okay, if we fight this, we're going to, you know, we're going to be more wounded than we were if we don't. So there's an advantage to not fighting them, and you don't get experience for killing them necessarily.
Right on.
So that worked.
In an effort to conserve time, because we're at about an hour here and we're not quite done with this, let's move on to talking about being a player. Because one of the things that I've mentioned a couple times now is that in order for a skill challenge to really work well, from all of them that I've experienced and all of them that I've heard, you need players that buy into the skill challenge. So what can I do as a player to make sure that the skill challenge is going well at the table where I'm at?
Well, that's a good question. I think one thing is you have to be open to them. You know, you have to recognize that this is one of the things about D&D that can be a lot of fun. A lot of it is going to depend upon what you are interested in as a player, and how good your DM is at running the challenges themselves. I think the people that are going to be the least interested are the tactical players who are going to want to just get right into a fight. I think almost everybody else will like a skill challenge on one sense. And the key is to really, again, like the design, like we were talking about with design, a player should kind of, you know, lean back, close your eyes, and imagine the situation that the DM is describing, and ask the detailed questions about how this door might work, or, you know, what else is around it, or what's the lighting like, and to give you an idea of what possible skills you can use.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I think if you want to have a lot of fun with a skill challenge as a player, then don't even think about the mechanics, you know? Make this a role-playing situation. Get into your character. What can they do? What would they think of? And be creative and come up with you know, the crazy fun solutions, and just get out there and be your character, and let your DM worry about how that translates mechanically.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that's the big one is that D&D, I mean, it has this reputation as being more of a tabletop war game than it is a role-playing game. And then again, it's because of how well the rules are refined around that. But
yeah.
Players should also remember that, well, this is part of D&D as well, and it helps. You know, one of the things that I really loved about Player's Handbook 2 are the character backgrounds that describe your background, give you little bits of bonuses to your mechanics through, you know, being a thief in a big city. Likewise, skill challenges are one of the ways that your character will be defined away from their statistics.
Yeah. And see, I know I've heard a lot of people who approach skill challenges very mechanically, right? And it's, okay, we're in the skill challenge. These are the skills that we figured out that are going to be useful. So everybody that can use aid another on the person who has the best score in that skill, and that's what we're going to do every single time. Everybody's going to aid this person, and they're going to do that, and we're going to rack up the successes and get past this challenge. And I don't know. I look at that and think, well, that's very that's very mechanical, and it doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me. Yeah, it doesn't sound like fun to me, you know?
Yeah, I was surprised when I actually hadn't even thought about that idea of stacking aid in others until I heard that in the podcast. And I can't imagine any DM would not just house rule that immediately.
Yeah.
Either house rule it or just say, well, you know, again, if more than two of you are not going to, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen, and you're actually going to be disadvantaged.
Well, and my instant thought when I see it is, oh, these are players that aren't really buying into skill challenge.
Yeah, right.
People that don't really get the point of a skill challenge. And so that's not what they're into. Let's give them what they are into and give them, you know, puzzles and traps and fights, because that's where they're at. That's what the kind of game they're looking for.
And that really, you know, one of the other tips, the general tips about all this is, like everything in D&D, keep it short. You know, don't over engineer a skill challenge, and don't, you know, come up with something so complicated that it takes you 20 minutes to describe it. You know, keep it short so that those players who aren't really interested in skill challenges won't be bored for too long. You know, and the people that do like them will be a little bit hungry for them, so they'll enjoy them more. Nobody likes it when a DM gets too long-winded with anything.
Yeah.
So the shorter and more specific it is, the better I think that challenge is going to be.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our discussion on skill challenges. To summarize sort of the big things that we've talked about today, we've talked about building an elven rogue. I think if you have to summarize building a rogue for damage or anything, you got to remember that Dex is king. And the dagger is awesome. It may not pull off a lot of damage as a weapon, but the rogue is all it's all about the sneak attack and the criticals, and if you can pull off a lot of that with that little dagger.
Yep.
And then we also talked a lot about skill challenges, and our general advice was relax, run it as a role-playing event, and sort of keep the mechanics in the background. Set them up in a way that's logical, and the skills and the DCs will sort of come naturally from that. And then use a lot of short skill challenges instead of big ones. And as a player, be open, come up with fun and creative solutions, and make this a real role-playing event for your character as well. Don't worry so much about what your skills are or what your roles are. Just come up with what would this character do, and the mechanics will flow from there. Does that sort of summarize our discussion tonight?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, Mike. Why don't you tell people again where they can find you on this Webernet thing I hear about?
The Webernet. I'm on multiple internets. Actually, slyflourish.com is the website URL, and there I have new articles every Monday morning, right in time for work, so you're using your boss's time instead of your own. And I have my DM tips twice daily on my Twitter feed at twitter.com/slyflourish. And I keep my tweets relatively light so I won't overflow people, and I try to have every tweet I post has a little nugget of something useful for DMs to make their game better.
And that's where I've really enjoyed what Sly Flourish has to offer is through the Twitter posts, because I get a couple of little things and that gets me thinking, and then I might see a link to the blog article from Monday and head to that and get more in depth with it. And that's sort of how you ended up on the show, because you had some advice on skill challenges that you had posted, and I said, hey, I want to talk about skill challenges. Why don't you come on?
Boy, I'm not qualified for that, but okay.
Well, and then you had even mentioned Quinn from the At Will blog.
Yeah, there's a lot of really great this is something else. There's so many good articles. And Quinn from At Will. And I know he was on the show before.
Yeah, he's been on the show several times, so it's like, well, that would be great.
Yeah, Bill from Chatty GM.
But I also wanted to sort of give somebody else a chance to get on the show. So
that's great. Thank you.
Here you are.
I've had a great time.
Good, good. Well, this has been episode 105. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Visit the forums if our Vorpal Network 2.0 site ever gets up and running, which it should be. I have full faith. It should be up soon. Don't forget to review the show on iTunes and tell people about it. Don't forget to consider checking out the Amazon store. And check out the new affiliate link with our new sponsor, rpgshop.com, where you can find products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And for links for these things and all the stuff that we've mentioned, and I've got a long list of links for this this episode, you can find all that on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 105, Elven Rogue and Skill Challenges of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.